Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today it's at 3:31. Today we have Senator Keel with us. We have Senator Rivak, Senator Bishop, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Geisel, and Coghill standing in for the chairman, who is on other business at this point in another committee. So today, we have quorum. And I am going to check to make sure my cell phone is off, and you all do the same, because I was not off the last committee, and it never rang, so I'm good. Today, we only have one item on the calendar today. We're going to have the Senate Bill 161. It's the geothermal resources. First heard on the 10th of February, and we have a presentation of the bill, and now the we open public testimony and set the bill aside for further consideration. And the department has revised their presentation to include a brief review of the bill. So why don't we have Steve Masterman come forward. And Steve, is it just going to be you, or do you want to bring Ms. Ogan?
Looks like I'm it.
You are it. Put yourself on a record. We, just for what it's worth, we online we have Dan Seamount also with the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and we have Sean Clifton online in Anchorage, and they're both available for questions. And I think later on we'll get to an issue where we may need those questions. Steve, put yourself on a record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Steve Masterman. I am State Geologist, Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, and it's good to be here with you today. It was 27 below on the way to the airport this morning in Fairbanks, so it's nice to be in where it's a little warmer. So what we're going to do today is complete the presentation that we started last time we were together. There's a couple of slides in there that are sort of a review for the tail end of that presentation, and then we'll get into the meat of it today. And what we plan to do today is primarily address the questions that came up during the last time discuss this bill. Rather than go through each section individually, we're going to focus on the issues that were raised. And so hopefully that will address some of the questions directly.
Thank you. That'll work.
Yep. Okay. So let's see if we can get this to work. Here we go. So this is just a kind of an overview of the presentation. And last time we met, we went through the review. We went through the geothermal. We went through the geothermal resources of the state, and this is an overview of today's presentation. We're going to go through the leasing history, what the purpose of the bill is, a little bit on the section analysis, and then some discussion of selected sections and the responses to the questions that came up last time. So just as a brief background here, as we discussed last time, geothermal systems are present in a number of places in our state, and where you can recover geothermal energy, it's a very efficient and cost-effective means to obtain electrical and heat energy. And hydrothermal systems around either old intrusive bodies or volcanoes are the most common sources for geothermal heat, as we know, out in the Aleutians and across the belt of granitic bodies in the interior. And usually you need a fair degree of geologic information to be able to develop a geothermal resource adequately, because you have to obviously be able to intercept the hot fluids and get them to the surface and not draw down the reservoir to the point that you can no longer produce. So it's kind of like an oil and gas system in a way. You have to balance what you're taking out with the availability of the system to replenish itself and keep supplying geothermal fluids to the boreholes. And one of the things that's important to consider when we go through this bill is that technologies are changing with regard to the use of geothermal energy, and they're allowing a broader range of geothermal resources to be developed, such as ground source heat pumps for home use or small businesses or university campuses across the nation are utilizing that, and there are places where dry but hot parts of the crust are being exploited for energy, where you put a fluid in artificially and recover that fluid, and then you extract the heat from the earth that way. So I think we need to be a little bit broader in our understanding of what can be done currently and what may be coming down the road. So this is just an overview again of the map of Alaska's hot springs, and they're broken into three different temperature bands. There are warm springs below 50 degrees Celsius on the surface, hot springs, which are in red on here, or kind of the orange color, and those are between 50 and 75 degrees, and then the darker red circles on here are greater than 75 degrees, and it just gives you a bit of an impression of where the hotter waters are around the state, and most of the hotter springs are along the Aleutian and the volcanic arc along the Aleutians in the Alaska Peninsula.
But we're blessed in the interior. With
we are. That's a pretty impressive little cluster there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty neat. Those are granite-related. Most of those granites are 50 to 70 million years old. And so they've been around a long time. They've cooled. Obviously, they're mostly exposed on the surface. And so those granite-related systems are where geology also plays a big part, because the hot water is hosted in fractures. And so you have to understand the fracture systems in order to...
I was just going to ask Senator Bishop, is there any power out at Manly Hot Springs? But maybe he has something else to bring up.
So the granite... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The granite intrusives, I think... I don't know if that's the right word, but is that indicative? Is that a rock? If you... Because Manly, the dome, I mean, that whole it's just one big solid granite mountain there.
Yes and no. That's the short answer. The long answer would be several PhD dissertations. But
would that be a sign?
It's a good sign, yes. Not all granites are created equally, though. And what you want is a younger granite, so it's had less time to cool. And you want the right composition, so it has the right elements in there that would generate the heat, to put it simply.
Please continue. I just wanted to make sure that our interior was on the map. That's all.
We're lots...
Okay, so that's just a brief review of the presentation last time, and now we'll start to get into the meat of today. This is a brief summary of DNR's geothermal leasing history. As you can see, it has been somewhat sporadic. The last actual lease was on Augustine Island in Cook Inlet in 2013, and currently there is one company who has an application pending for a geothermal exploration prospecting permit, and that is, I guess, in process right now, and a best interest finding is anticipated in 2020. So the purpose of this bill is really threefold. The first, and those are the major bullets there, is to diversify Alaska's energy portfolio. Obviously, we're very petroleum-centered in our energy resources, particularly in rural Alaska. There's some wind, but not a huge amount, and this source of energy has potential to be viable in a number of rural communities. In Nome, there's potential for geothermal energy from the Pilgrim Hot Springs, and on Alaska, there's potential from the McCushion geothermal field, and then there's a number of communities on the Alaska Peninsula as well that have potential, as well as some additional potential in interior Alaska. So this could materially help some of our rural communities that are so dependent on petroleum products for their electrical generation. It also streamlines our process for leasing, or what is currently permitting, geothermal exploration, and this aligns it more with oil and gas leasing, and that's a process that is obviously very well established within the Division of Oil and Gas and that they're very familiar with. So making this align more with oil and gas leasing, it does a number of things. Partly it helps the Division of Oil and Gas with the leasing program, but it also materially helps companies who are coming into the state looking to explore geothermal resources. And we'll go into that a little bit more detail. And then it redefines what a geothermal resource is, and removes the temperature criteria in there and brings the definition more in line with the evolving state of geothermal industry and brings it more to focus on commercial uses. So this is a brief very, well, it's a lot of words, but it's sort of a brief sectional summary. And don't worry, I'm not going to read this slide. But really, much of the bill replaces permits with licenses. And this goes from a permitting system to a licensing system. And the original or the current legislation had a 2-year permits. And this changes that into a 5-year license term. And I think that's very attractive for an explorer with some of the other changes that are being made.
So, Mr. Messman, the primary purpose of that is it looks like in your purpose statement it says aligning with oil and gas exploration license program. Is that the genesis of that this particular?
No, I believe it was really to provide more time for companies to explore an area before they had to make the decision to move forward to the next step. Under the current statutes, they have 2 years, and then to move to the next step, they have to have defined a commercially developable resource. And here, that gives them more time, and it removes that requirement to define a commercially viable resource before they can move to the next step, which is substantive.
Senator Bishop, you had your hand up.
I did. Mr. Masterman, can you tell me, is this license, if I had this license, and it's a 5-year license, correct, as it's written in the bill, could I sell this license?
That is a question I do not know the answer to, but I believe there are probably people online who would know the answer to that question. And
Who would be the answer? We have Sean Clifton and Dan Seamount online at this point.
I would ask Sean Clifton that question.
Mr. Clifton, did you hear Senator Bishop's question?
I sure did. This is Sean Clifton with the DNR Division of Oil and Gas. And the answer to that question is yes. A license can be assigned to another party.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please continue, Mr.
Okay.
Masterman.
Any other questions on this slide? Okay. Now, this is another area I think that there will be some questions about, the private use exemption. And so I'll go through this, and then perhaps we can ask question. So one of the things that the governor requested when we were working on this legislation was to ensure that there is a specific exemption for private users of geothermal resources. And so we have attempted to do that in this statute. The new language in there in the first bullet, a prospecting license or lease is not required under this section to explore for, develop, or use geothermal resources if the geothermal resource is intended for domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial uses. So that's the new language that is going into the bill. That's the modified version of the language that will be going into the bill. And this explicitly excludes private geothermal users from requiring a license or a lease in order to develop their geothermal resources that are on their property.
Senator Bishop.
Under this, Mr. Masterman, on this amendment, includes. I don't like using this word, but I'm assuming that I would still have to go through all the permitting protocol to drill and get a drilling approval plan from AOGCC and et cetera, et cetera. Is that right?
I believe that is the correct, Senator. Yes.
Thank you. Please continue. One question. Small-scale industrial use, is that easily defined, or is that an open topic for discussion?
I imagine that would be open to discussion, as it is not defined numerically. I would think that, say, a fish processing plant would want to use geothermal energy, I would think that would be small scale. But if a Alcoa wanted to move in and build a aluminum smelter and use geothermal energy for that I would think would be more of a large scale industrial use.
Those are the two bookends, but when we get into the middle ground, that could be a little more difficult. Senator Kawasaki.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Steve, for being here. Just a really quick question on the 30 degree that was deleted. What was the, why was the 30 degrees Celsius set in the original legislation?
Yes, through the chair, thank you. That's a good question. So most home uses of, or small-scale uses of geothermal energy are the ground source heat pumps. And they are very much low-temperature systems that really just use sort of ambient ground temperature and don't necessarily have an elevated geothermal gradient like you would find around a hot springs. And so that was an arbitrary number that was used. It's a number that is used elsewhere in the United States and other states that have statutes on this. Other states define it based on the technical specifications of PVC pipe. So if it's above the temperature which PVC pipe can be utilized, then it's no longer exempt from these regulations. So 30 degrees, though, is a hard number, and it was requested to be withdrawn by AOGCC to provide them more flexibility in administering this, this exemption from regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Mesterman.
Thanks. So next slide, preferential rights. And this is definitely an area where if you have questions, I will be calling on the experts on the phone.
Right.
So there was some deletion of language, and I believe that the language for preferential rights was deleted because it was more relevant to surface water rights than it was to geothermal waters. However, surface rights are protected under statute, and the statute's listed here. One of the things that I think is occurring here is the geothermal resources are being treated more like oil and gas and mineral resources, so they're a mineral that are present in the ground. They're a mineral estate and not a surface estate, and so we have a surface estate versus mineral estate issue, and this is attempting to clarify that distinction. So there are certain issues, and Senator Keel brought one up earlier today, a situation where, say, a person has a very small-scale use of a geothermal system to heat their home, and then a company comes in and leases the area around them and presumably under them, then how is that conflict resolved, or should there be a conflict, how would it be resolved? And there are measures in place currently in statute to resolve conflicts between surface and subsurface ownership. And those have been very rarely used in the oil and gas world, but they are present in statute. And there is a process in place, and I am not the expert to answer questions on that, but there are people online who would be able to provide that information if there are questions about that.
Since your name was brought up, Senator Keel, do you want to follow that line of questioning? Because I do have some questions, but you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to wait for the next slide, but this is just as good a slide. The reference there is to 3805.130, which is about, I think, requires full payment for damages to the surface owner, and that's about all it says. So if I could get a rundown on how that would work, that would help me maybe understand the protection.
Okay. If I may call on Sean Clifton again.
Sean, put yourself back on the record, and if you heard that question.
Yes. This is Sean Clifton with DNR Division of Oil and Gas. And to make sure that I heard the question correctly, you are noting that 3805.130, the statute, talks about it's perhaps not as explanatory referring to repaying damages. But the regulation under that is relevant to this is 11 AAC 86145, and that clarifies how this problem is to be approached by the commissioner. And so that's where that is clarified that, you know, if a private agreement between the developer and the landowner can't be reached, and those things are usually settled privately without any trouble or without much trouble, but If they can't reach an agreement, then the commissioner will hold a hearing and will basically hear both sides. And if the developer can't prove that there's another alternative location another way to resolve it, then the commissioner will direct that a bond be posted and compensation of the landowner will be ensured that way. And, you know, there may be other stipulations too, but that's the basics.
To continue on that line of questioning, Senator Bishop.
I want to go to 125 when we're done with 130.
Okay. But before we do, on 130, Sean, if we amend this statute, which is 05-181, does that impact the regulation under 130? Just to get us centered.
But if there were a case came up where we recognized that there was a deficiency in the regulation, then of course we would seek to revise the regulations to meet our current needs.
Okay, we'll start there. Senator Bishop, you wanted to ask him a question as well?
Yes, I do. I have a question to Mr. Clifton. This rights to access to the mineral estate under 05-125, explain how that would be resolved if I want to move my drilling rig across this property and the guy says no. So what's the cure? Does the commissioner determine that, or do we got to go to a silver court, or how's that handled?
Yes, I mean, like I said, surface use agreements are usually met with private landowners. There's lots of examples of this on in the Cook Inlet area on the peninsula, and but if they were not able to come to an agreement, then yes, then it would have to be resolved by some intervention with the commissioner to ensure that there was access to that mineral estate.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Yep.
Thank you, Sean. Other questions? Okay, continue. Mr. Masterman, thank you.
Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide 10. So this is sort of recapping that previous slide, but a couple points to make here is that conflicts are, in some ways, not very likely to happen. There's only a few places in the state where you have overlapping interests of geothermal resources and private land ownership. And so the number of situations where you may have personal use conflicting with industrial use are not very numerous.
Steve, because there's so much public land in Alaska and private issues are so dear to us, we would be loath to surrender any private right at all, but we want to have the rest of Alaska served well. This is true, but at least for me, private right is something we hold very precious here. So just for what it's worth.
Yep, duly noted. And I think that this bill does not degrade private rights. I think that they're being well met and protected with the statute and the regulations that are in place. So the next slide, slide 11, really is a breakdown of the areas of responsibility of the Division of Oil and Gas, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and the Department of Environmental Conservation. And this perhaps speaks to some of your questions earlier today as well, Senator Keel, in that the Division of Oil and Gas really looks at this from the land management and surface permitting viewpoint, and they are also the entity who would be collecting any royalties and lease payments. And then AOGCC is looking at this from the drilling permitting standpoint, from the protection of groundwater, from the determination of whether it's private or use or commercial use. And the Department of Environmental Conservation looks at this from the standpoint of the environmental impacts from using that water and any discharge from use of that water or discharge of the water into the environment. They also issue permits for hydrostatic testing and for aquifer or pump testing. So the various entities have different parts of the leasing, permitting, and environmental compliance aspect of a geothermal system. Next slide, royalty reduction. And this, again, aligns with the protocols that are present in oil and gas royalties as well. The royalties are different, but the protocols are basically the same. One thing to note here is that to date, no royalties have been charged on geothermal resources, so the process is a little bit uncemented, shall we say, but hopefully that will change, and as resources are developed, then there will be some royalties to charge. Royalties are 1.75% of gross revenue for the first 10 years, and then that increases to 3.5% after 10 years. Geothermal energy is a little different than oil and gas in that it's not a volumetric product, so it's not like a barrel of oil or a cubic feet of gas. You're extracting energy in the form of heat or in the form of electricity, and so the royalties are charged on gross sales instead of the volume of material that is produced. So if there are no sales, there are no royalties.
So just to flesh that out a little bit for anybody watching us, if you pushed into the side of a volcano and were getting the heat out of that and you had a water loop coming out of there, would it be based on the water temperature going through or on what the water temperature produced as an energy source?
It would be based on the amount of energy that is sold. So if you're selling the heat from that to heat homes or a building, or then it would be based on that. Or if it were based on the electricity that you're generating, it would be based on the sale and the price of the electricity.
The final product.
Yeah, the final product. Yeah.
All right. Just for anybody who has a big geothermal thing in your backyard.
Another change in the statute is that lease payments are currently set at $3 per year per acre, I believe, and the change would be to make them set by regulation, not by statute. That way they could be modified if necessary.
So, good question. So that would be based on what, the geographical accessibility, the thermal temperature, what would that be based on? What do you see as a criteria?
I'm not aware of any conversations within the department that would apply a variable rate to the leasing per acre. I think what is envisioned is a flat rate per acre for the entire state, so it's the same everywhere. It is an interesting concept to have a variable rate depending on the attractiveness or the potential energy of the system, but I don't think that the department has evolved its thinking, or I'm not aware of it having evolved its thinking to that point yet.
And the reason I was asking, in order to open this up to a better commerce capacity, trying to think of how it may be used, looking at the four different geographical areas that have thermal energy in any kind of mass, they would be three very different economic units. And I was just wondering how you might see a statutory provision that is blanket over against a regulation that was blanket, and why that would be useful. And so I'm just thinking out loud here.
If you don't mind, I would like to offer Sean the opportunity to comment on that.
Sean, did you hear the comment on the statute versus a regulation and how that might look?
Okay, this is Sean Clifton, DNR Division of Oil and Gas, and I think I might want to back up and explain this rationale just a little bit. We want our per acre rental rates to be competitive. We want to be able to get our due for our resource to the state, but we also want it to be competitive to attract developers to come and develop our resource. And so I think this $3 per acre that's in statute is kind of an archaic holdover, and it needs to be more flexible. And we've done that for a long time with our oil and gas lease rental rates. Access is more difficult and more remote, or perhaps where the prospective resource is judged to be a little bit lower, we ask for a significantly lower rental rate per acre than we do for the more prospective, more competitive areas. And this is most easily seen on the North Slope. In Cook Inlet, our rental rates are a little bit more fixed. We don't have high and low areas in the Cook Inlet. And so we would judge our rental rates by what we think that we can sell them for, or what we can get bidders for. And that's something that will change over time, and that's exactly why we want it not to be specified in statute, because that is much harder to modify.
The way I understand it, Sean, a regulation would go out for public comment, and that would be your way of testing what the market capacity is?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Point well taken. All right. Thank you. Let's move on then. Thank you.
The next slide addresses one of the amendments that were offered to the piece of legislation, and that is a changing the definition of geothermal fluids. And along with changing the definition of a geothermal resource, the change to the definition of a geothermal fluid removes the temperature of 120 degrees Celsius essentially from the definition, and just makes it broad to apply to all of the geothermally heated fluids, whether brines, waters, gases, whether they're naturally or artificially present, but specifically excludes hydrocarbons from the definition.
And we have that amendment in front of us, which will...
I believe it's part of the package, yes. Any questions? On the last, I believe this may be the last slide, and this one is dealing with the new definition for geothermal resource. And as with the previous slide, the new definition removes the temperature of 120 degrees from the statute, and that temperature has been removed to, as I mentioned, to allow more flexibility in inclusion of systems at a lower temperature that could be utilizing some of our state's geothermal resources and generating electricity or heat. And this definition would be the same for the Department of Natural Resources and for AOGCC. Currently, the definitions are slightly different, and this would align the two definitions together.
And we do have Dan Seamount online who can answer some of those questions. If there's questions on that, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm working through the water piece of this. And I see that in the previous slide, geothermal fluid includes the water. But under this new definition, the water itself is not a resource, or not a geothermal resource. So I'm just trying to make sure my head is clear. DNR is going to cover the heat. AOGCC is going to cover the risk of somebody getting killed by a blowout. DEC is going to do the water. DNR is going to do the minerals in the water. It's striking me as a pretty complex permit system. Who goes first?
That's a good question. I do not know the answer to who goes first, but perhaps either Sean or Dan could address that question.
Well, we can start with Sean, since he has been first online, then we can get Dan to chime in as well. So, Sean, did you hear the question all right?
Yes, I did. This is Sean Clifton, DNR Division of Oil and Gas. And the first thing that has to be done for a commercial operation, which is what we're talking about here, is commercial development, would be disposal of the land or disposal of the mineral interest. So we would have to go through the expiration license and then eventually lease process through the Division of Oil and Gas. And so we would be first. And then whatever drilling operations that would go on in that, we would generally approve through a plan of operations, but the specific approvals for individual wells would be AOGCC, and then the specific approvals for discharge and other related type concerns would be Department of Environmental Conservation. Does that clarify what you were asking, Senator Gill?
Mr. Chairman, I think so. I guess the follow-on question for AOGCC would be whether they just are doing well safety or whether they're preventing waste of the resource here the way they do with hydrocarbon.
So, Mr. Seamount, did you hear that question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Very well. Thank you. Put yourself on the record and answer that question. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Dan Seamount. I'm a geologic commissioner for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And generally, we're the last people in line. We approve the drilling permits and make sure they drill a well in the correct way. And we make sure that they don't waste the resource and they enhance the production as much as possible. As far as cost is concerned, we haven't fully figured that out yet. We charge the oil and gas companies on how much fluid they produce and how much they inject. We have a formula for that. As far as geothermal, it's a lot more complex. Are we going to look at steam? We can look at water or some other way to put them on our budget. Let's see, were there any other question, any other part of the question I didn't answer?
I think that got it pretty good, Mr. Seamount. Were you satisfied, Senator?
Yeah, thank you. Just that AOGCC also prevents waste of geothermal resource. Yeah. That was the key. Thank
All right.
You.
And obviously, this is a work in progress that we'd like to see progress. So we do have any other questions for Mr. Masterman at this point?
Just a comment.
Yes,
on the Bishop. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say that the definition update is warranted. Bernie Carl has proved that you can generate electrons at a lower temperature, at the lowest temperature to date.
Mm-hmm. So we do have an amendment, and what I'd like to do, Mr. Masterman, at this point is bring the amendment that you proposed to us and have Senator Bishop propose the amendment. I'll object, and then we'll have you go through the discussion on it. And I know that Mr. Seamount also is going to speak to it to some degree. So, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment A.3.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion, and so... I know this is brought to us by the administration, so Steve, you want to explain to us, or do I go to another helpline?
I could run through it briefly, and then Mr. Seamount could add to my comments as well. So there's basically two parts to the amendment. The first part is the removal of the 30-degree temperature limit on exclusions for domestic or small industrial uses, and that was requested by AOGCC, as I mentioned, to provide them more flexibility in providing that exclusion to small-scale uses. And I think that that's a beneficial change to the bill in that it broadens the range of geothermal systems or geothermal uses that would be excluded from the leasing and licensing portion of the statute, so it'd be better for small users.
So, for anybody listening online, that's page 1, line 13 through 14, and page 4, line 26 and 27. And then the other part.
The second part is the change in the definition of geothermal fluid, which removes the 120-degree temperature criteria in there, broadens it to basically all fluids, and then adds a specific exclusion for hydrocarbons. And that's just more or less to conform it with the other changes in the definitions to geothermal resources.
So we had Dan Seamount. This is downhole stuff, so is there anything that you, Mr. Seamount, want to talk to us concerning this amendment, for it, against it, helpful, not helpful?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start by saying we, the AOGCC is definitely in favor of this bill, and we're in favor of the amendments. And I'll just spend a minute to go through the amendments. Simply, for one thing, we're proposing to remove the reference to temperatures of 120 degrees Celsius in the definition of general geothermal fluid so that it's consistent and would not lead to confusion with the definition of geothermal resources, which also you say 120 degrees. The other thing about the 120 degrees is one of the most successful geothermal projects in the world is in Klamath Falls, Oregon, and they heat the entire town with temperatures of 87 to 112 degrees Celsius. So would we define that as a geothermal resource at 120 degrees? I don't know. Someone could make a case that we couldn't. I think Mr. Masterson explained the 30-degree, cutting out the 30-degree Celsius pretty well. It would give the commissioner more flexibility and latitude. It's also interesting to note that at Cheetah Hot Springs, Bernie Carl produces, it looks like the lowest temperature power generation in the world at 74 degrees Celsius. So 120 degrees would not even apply here.
Yeah, no, we are very proud of Mr. Bernie.
But I worked for 2 years in geothermics, and I got my master's in geothermics, and some literature says geothermal resources worldwide can range from 10 degrees C, which I assume would be the heat pumps, to more than 350 degrees C, which is an incredible temperature. When they test those wells, it sounds like 10 747s going off, and it comes out as steam. But in any case, we support this bill. We support the amendments. I know of four geothermal attempts in Alaska since I've had this job, and three out of the four would not meet those temperature constraints. So I think we think the amendments are the right way to go, and everything else sounds great to us.
Thank you.
That's all I have to say.
Thanks, Dan. Any other questions on this particular amendment? Well, then I'll remove my objection, and we'll have the amendment go into the bill. We're at the point where I think public testimony was closed at one point, wasn't it?
It was, but I just had a note here to reopen it.
Yeah, and so so what we're going to do is we're going to reopen public testimony at this point, and I'm going to ask, is there anybody in the room that has any comment on this while we have Mr. Masterman here? And there's nobody online at this point, but I wanted to make sure that we had every opportunity. All right, then I'll close public testimony. So we'll do it. So at this point, we have Senate Bill 161 as amended before us. And any last comments based on some of the questions we had? Any discussion on the bill at this point?
I just have a comment.
Yeah, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a comment, and we're obviously in some new territory here going forward, and I'm just wondering, have we reached out, meaning DNR, AOGCC, reached out to a country like Iceland and asked best practices? Do we, you know, if we have, you know, as we're working our way through this, have we thought about reaching out to, maybe you're already doing it, I don't know.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's a good question. Some of that is already happening. I reached out through the State Geological Association to all the other states to find out what their practices are with regard to regulating geothermal resources and get copies of their statutes to look at their definitions and how they were addressing issues with home use and small-scale uses versus industrial uses. So some of that is definitely happening. Reaching out to Iceland, I don't know about going on trips right now to foreign places like Iceland and New Zealand. It might be a little bit hard.
Any other discussion on Senate Bill 161? Senator Bishop, motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 161, version 31-GS2177/A, as amended from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Any objection to moving the bill as amended? All right, with that, the bill passes without objection. Please stand by to sign the paperwork on this. That does conclude the meeting for today. Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Thanks for Lynn Smith helping us out today and for the chairman trusting me with a gavel. With that, we're adjourned.